I think we probably all knew that the vote on whether or not COVID passes need to be used was going to go through, didn't we? We knew that. I mean, I suspected that, but I was quite, it really sort of gutted me for a while that this is the 2 weeks to flatten the curve have become this, you know, where it's so plainly obvious that it has absolutely nothing at all to do with viruses and everything to do with control from the top down. But the fact that over 100 Tory MPs rebelled was, you know, a little bit of a glimmer of hope, because previously virtually none of the Tories rebelled. But what's really, really disgusting and shocking to me is the level of compliance among the Labour Party, that only 8 MPs went against it. I mean, it's an absolutely, honestly, it's just the total erasure of political processes, you know.
Well, so I mean, it's basically an open goal for Keir Starmer and the Labour Party that they decided, oh no, let's just kick it into the sidelines.
Well, it's an open goal in terms of, you know, you can see that this is actually going to destroy all the things that they claim they want to defend, you know. Now they've brought in the mandatory vax for healthcare workers. And so consequently, there will be the mass walkout, presumably, of those something like 30%, 1 in 3 of healthcare professionals who have made the decision, have chosen for themselves, from what they have actually witnessed, that they do not want this injection because they worked throughout the pandemic or so-called pandemic and didn't get sick or recovered with no harm. And they don't think they need it. You know, they absolutely don't need it. They've survived the pandemic and they don't need anything. And so they don't want to be part of this experiment because they've seen the harms, you know, of people coming into the hospital who have been jabbed once or twice, and they don't want to be part of that. So that's going to destroy the NHS, you know, because they're already grinding to a halt, you know, with this ludicrous, basically, you know, it's a completely coercive measure to get people to be boosted, you know, because once they say, okay, well, 2 vax isn't enough now for your COVID pass, you've got to have 3, everyone who's had 2 is going to be back in the, oh, I can't do this, I've got to get the 3rd one. And they're going to realize, some of them at least, I know some people have been clapping and cheering about getting their booster jab, but I think a lot of people now are beginning to realize that this whole thing is about control and it had nothing at all to do about the virus. So,
well, if people are clapping and cheering, you can be guaranteed that from behind a bush, a TV camera person will jump out and make sure that that's headline news, because they're definitely, they're not really putting both sides at all. I'd also just like to point out about healthcare workers. I think it's fascinating that we've got this, one of the biggest networks, companies of care homes in the country, Four Seasons Healthcare. Well, they actually tried to do a legal challenge against the government sacking their workers for not having a jab, which one would have thought in any kind of normal judicial system would be successful, but they weren't. And And as a result of that, then there was a panorama program made about them, saying with undercover filming inside their Four Seasons healthcare homes. And so the BBC decided that that they were a good target for some sort of sting investigative documentary. This particular chain. Now, I don't, you know, of course, if you go into most care homes, you will find some form of things not 100% right. But it just seemed to me that, that they'd been specifically targeted because of their stance on vaccines for their staff.
Yes. I'm afraid all these so-called documentaries always are a sort of setup to present the government's the status quo narrative. There's no more investigative journalism in the mainstream. It basically either works to only shed a light on an allowed corner that can be exposed briefly, but mostly it's there to distract and deflect from what's really going on. So this whole business is about it being an own goal. Labour are going to lose their heartland. They've probably already lost it. Because none of this is actually going to help the working person, the, you know, the blue collar worker, the vulnerable. It's not going to help any of them. And again, so this is part and parcel of what was, what has been a 10, 15 year process to destroy the NHS. And this is going to be the final nail in the coffin, because they won't, they'll be massively understaffed. It will drain morale for anyone else who's remaining, because they'll be massively overworked and underpaid. And the whole system will just be on a constant state of on the brink of collapse. I mean, it'll just, and eventually everything will be sold off to the massive US corporations, which are literally like, a lion in a zoo who's waiting to pounce on the deer that's just been slaughtered for it. You know, it's incredible. It's incredible that all of these unions, the healthcare unions, you know, they keep beefing on about pay rises when they're literally shooting themselves in the foot. Not only are they shooting themselves in the foot, they're basically amputating their own leg.
Well, I'd say also, even blowing their brains out at the same time, because if you look at some of the effect of on the morale and the cohesion amongst healthcare teams of mandating something which the evidence suggests is actually very potentially very, certainly in some way, but potentially very damaging to your health, has this kind of air of mass irrationality about it, which is designed, I think, to actually destroy any kind of morale that there might be amongst teams, and also confidence in management, confidence in the union. And so this will have an enormous psychological effect, I think, on the health service as a whole.
Yeah, I would agree. It probably won't be long before they start mandating it for teachers. And eventually, you know, they may well try to mandate it for the whole population. And, you know, we've all been saying this, people who've been warning others about this inevitability, that this is what it's coming to now. And it's, you know, it's evident in countries where they've already mandated their whole entire populations to have it. So, you know, what do we do? Well, somebody sent me something just today or yesterday in a message, And it's, you know, it's a piece of legislation. And yeah, I don't know why nobody is, or whether or not this is actually being part of any type of legal challenge. But it really should be, because what the government is doing now is completely, seems to me, to be going against their own laws and statutes. So the piece of legislation that I was, my attention was drawn to was the Public Health Control of Disease Act 1984. So I went to that link at legislation.gov, and in section 45B and C, the Act talks about, you know, what sort of regulations appropriate ministers can take in times of an infection or contamination, spread of infection or contamination. And, you know, they talk about, they have the ability to, you know, restrict travel and to search various locations and items of personal belonging. And or I mean, it's quite draconian what they already are allowed to do. And it's all spelt out in 45B and 45C. And then it goes on, talks about in 45D, restrictions on the power to make regulations. But then 45E, so section 45E of this 1984 Act, Public Health Control of Disease Act, it specifically says regulations, so 45E, medical treatment. One, regulations under section 45B or 45C, which are those that restrict and, you know, the rules that they can apply, may not include provision requiring a person to undergo medical treatment. Two, quote, medical treatment, unquote, includes vaccination and other prophylactic treatment. That seems to me clear as day. I'm confused. I'm confused now because they've mandated it for healthcare workers. They mandated it, did they not, for nursing homes, care workers. And essentially, they're mandating it for everyone else by insisting that in order to participate in, you know, going to any type of large event or nightclub or what have you, any type of club, presumably that's open at night, that you have to show a pass. So they're twisting your arms one way or another way, making life extremely, well, at this stage, it may not be that difficult for some people. So they might think, well, it's all right. I can still manage. I can still carry on. I can still live a fairly normal life, even with these restrictions in place, because they don't really affect me. I don't go to nightclubs. I don't go to big venues. I don't go to concerts. I don't, you know. But it won't stop at that. And that's what people have to realize. Because all of this has been an escalation from day one. 2 weeks to flatten the curve has escalated inexorably to this. And they always, always do a two steps forward, one step back shuffle. Every single time. It's baked into the program. This is what they have to do in order to achieve what they intend to achieve. And so they do this two-step forward, one-step back shuffle. You think they're not going anywhere, but actually they're going forward incrementally all the time.
Well, one important thing I think about the nightclubs is it's quite obvious to me that you get young people go to nightclubs who are not in any way vulnerable to Omicron and weren't actually either vulnerable to Delta or any other version of COVID. And they would actually benefit from catching it by, so long as they didn't have underlying health conditions, by having produce antibodies and giving them natural immunity to it. So it seems that this whole vaccine passport thing is being targeted against the very people who the disease doesn't affect. It's unbelievable. But I think there is a positive side, and that is that it's quite likely that those organisations that don't go too harshly and don't mandate too much on this, if they're not targeted and shut down by the government, they are the ones that are likely to attract more young people.
Yeah, well, let's hope so. I mean, the lawyers, Lawyers for Light, or you know, the organize or the group, they put out a message last night or this morning, or I can't remember when exactly, basically saying, do not comply. Just do not comply. If you have a COVID pass, don't. Go places, don't display it, don't use it, don't get the lateral flow test or whatever in order to get into places. Don't, whatever you do, try and get a fake pass. Just do not play ball. Do not interact. Do not give them any oxygen whatsoever. And unfortunately, there will be people. I know people. I personally know, as I mentioned before in previous talks, women, intelligent women, I assumed, who will go along with this. But hopefully there is a significant number of people who will not. And it's absolutely essential that people do not even play ball, I think. And to support those places that actively support them and vociferously make a point that you will support them and that you do support them when they say they are not going to be discriminatory, that they are not going to participate in a two-tier medical apartheid system. Support those people by all means. I mean, for example, there's been some to and fro. Yeah, we've got thunder and lightning going on here. I don't know if you can hear it, but Russell Brand, you know, people have been debating his legitimacy because allegedly he basically asks for passes and things, you know, his handlers or whatever, to go to his gigs, he requires people to have a negative test or a COVID pass. And so, you know, people are saying, well, why is he doing that? If he's really awake, if he's really, you know, if he's really a genuine guy, why would he do that? We think he's a shill, yada, yada, yada. And then other people going, well, actually, you know, he's going under the radar. He's, you know, he's letting the normies, so-called quote unquote normies, into his show, and then he's giving them some truths, you know. I don't know. Personally, I think you should not, you cannot indulge bullies, comply with tyranny, because it harms yourself as much as harming others. It sullies your soul. And the negative, if you like, energies from these institutions and these individuals and organizations, the negative energies that they produce, if you interact, then you're facilitating the continuation of that negative energy. You're not breaking the loop. You know, you're enabling the loop. That's my personal feeling on it.
But what about this idea that there is a sort of built-in problem with what they're trying to do, and that is that those institutions, whether they be cafes, hotels, restaurants, nightclubs, that it go along with all of this and make it very strict, because of course you don't have to make it quite as strict if you don't want to. Those are the ones that really clamp down are the ones that are simply, you know, going to lose business. And so that seems to be almost hardwired into this.
Yeah, it might be. I mean, we don't know that. We don't know how it's going to play. And of course, they're going to use every tactic imaginable to force businesses to comply and force people to comply. And if certain businesses force really hard and they lose profits, you know, maybe the Mr. Global, as Catherine Austin Fitz likes to call the big overarching global kleptocracy, maybe they think it's totally acceptable for those businesses to go to the wall. You know, it's I mean, in Russia, for example, in Moscow, apparently way back, I think it was in July of this year, the mayor of Moscow tried to enforce a system of COVID passes. And the people just, even people who maybe had them, they just refused to comply. And eventually the businesses themselves said to the mayor, look, we're suffering. Stop this nonsense. You know, let people come if they want to. However, it looks like Russia's tightening the screws again. So that little dalliance in the summer was maybe just a little bit of test the waters type of thing to see what reaction they'd get. But
yeah, it also may be that they're trying to, you know, to sit on that whole situation and control it before the rest of the world gets to see it and gets to know what's going on, because that's the sort of story we just don't hear at all, do we? That the way that Moscow just said no to these COVID passes. Well, look, we had the Tory MP for Yeovil, whose name escapes me for the time being, saying, you know, we don't live in, if this is on a Radio 5 Live debate, we don't live in a where is your past country, and this is not Nazi Germany, which is actually, I think, is really the first time that one of the MPs has come out and started making these sorts of comparisons in public.
Yeah. Was that Steve Baker or no? I don't know who's the MP for Yeovil, but yeah, no, I mean, it's good. It's good that people are calling it by what it is. And it's just, it's kind of mind bending that it, to me anyway, that it's people from the Tory party, MPs from that side, who are making these really strong statements. I'd like to check what their voting record had been, though. I mean, because it's all very well calling it out now when you've kind of enabled it up till then. And as UK Column pointed out, you know, they've also voted in a lot of legislation. All of these guys, all of these MPs who may have voted against the COVID pass and so on, but they voted in all the previous legislation that is basically what UK Column and what some people would describe it as enabling acts of a completely totalitarian, dictatorial state, you know, with the various the covert Human Intelligence Sources Act and the Police and Crimes Bill Act, they're going to no doubt go for the Official Secrets Act as well, and so on. They're putting in the structures, or they've already put in the structures to allow for virtually all sectors of civil society to commit a criminal act up to and including murder and not be accountable for it in the pursuit of quote-unquote national security and so on. So they've literally given themselves endless numbers of passes to commit crimes against their own people, and then they're also going to no doubt pass the protest bill, the Police and Crimes Bill, against legitimate, well, any kind of protest, shutting down protests, shutting down journalism. And they're really, they have done everything in their power to forestall and prevent the investigation of crimes, the persecution of crimes by the state, the prosecution of crimes rather, and the, you know, the voice of the people. They have done everything to ensure that these things will not be part and parcel of, you know, the British state going forward. And that basically, you might as well be living in Turkey, Tony, because that's what it's like here. And if you don't, you know, you get to a point where you don't discuss politics, you can't post anything online, you can't say anything against the state, not a word. You can't criticize it. You can't criticize their policies. You can't criticize people. You just cannot say anything oppositional at all.
About this whole...
Yeah, not on social media, not even to friends or family in case they dob you in. That's the level the UK will get to.
One of the things that seems to get lost in the looking at this Intelligence Sources Bill. What's that one called? Human Intelligence. Yes, one is. It seems pretty obvious to me that this is a response to the publicity that there's been around criminal acts by the police. So, for example, not only hacking people's lives, but actually having children with them in an attempt to infiltrate groups and actually targeting, rather than organised crime, which, you know, obviously they may bite back organised crime, targeting specific, say, environmental groups, etc., which are not even breaking the law. They're actually doing perfectly lawful protests. And so they are not breaking the law. They've been targeted anyway, and crimes have been committed by the police. And the first of all, the extent of those crimes was never revealed. The Pitchford inquiry just ground to a halt as it became clear that they were not going to get the evidence that there was, that the police had, of all of the various operations that took place. And so what they've done is they, rather than actually prosecuted those crimes, they've covered those crimes up, and they're now legislating to make sure that they can do these things with impunity in the future.
Right, absolutely. I mean, I don't. Yeah, as you say, they weren't prosecuted, or if they were, it was somehow it just tailed off. So I mean, they got away with it. They got away with it in the past, but now they're ensuring that with more kinds of social media platforms where people can actually now, share information. across all sorts of various mechanisms. You know, and people can screenshot and they can do all kinds of various things where they could maybe actually expose people to a greater degree than maybe previously was possible. That now it's fixed in cement, more or less, that, you know, while they're still going to be able to get away with it. And there's no comeback for you or I. So, yeah, it's an absolutely abysmal, appalling state of affairs. And as Catherine Austin Fitz said in a recent interview she did in the Netherlands, was that, you know, you can try and turn the ship early on, but you can't turn it once it's a centimeter from the iceberg or 10 foot from the iceberg. You can't move. You can't actually turn the aircraft carrier or the massive Titanic from an iceberg when you're literally 10 feet away from it. And when the interviewer asked her, well, you know, how close are we to the iceberg? And she said, we're in it. We're in it. I mean, it's bad. This is bad. however, I don't think they know what all the consequences of these actions will be. And so that's the big unknown. Right, is how the general public will react. And yes, they'll know that for sure some people will go along with it. They know that. But to what extent and how much of the general public will go along with it? I don't think they know that. Whatever polls they put out are completely manipulated. So if they're telling politicians that, oh, the polls indicate this and the polls indicate that, the politicians are not getting an accurate sense of the public mood. And to be honest, at this, I think it's pretty clear that the politicians aren't in charge. And again, this is what Catherine Austin Fitz so clearly explains whenever she talks about what's going on. It's a financial coup and the bankers are taking control. And, you know, they basically usurped, they've just told the politicians, do as we say, more or less, and we'll ensure that you have a cushy retirement, you know, but if you don't, we have ways and means. And I mean, that, I know that sounds ridiculous, but I think there's enough evidence now for most people who do a little bit of digging. And Catherine Austin Fitz herself explained how, you know, she was targeted. You can see over and over again, as we've talked about, just on the lower levels, let's say, and they're not even that. I mean, I don't want to diminish what they've done and who they are, but people like Chris Exley, you know, Mr. Aluminium, and people like Andrew Wakefield, Dr. Andrew Wakefield, and all these other across all sectors of people who are experts at their profession, and they have moral courage, and they speak up and they say, no, this isn't right. Something is not right, which is what Catherine Austin Fitz did, you know, back in 1997. She saw all these billions of dollars disappearing at that stage. It's now in the multi-trillions of U.S. Reserve or whatever, the in the financial system, in the government. Funds just disappearing, vanishing, And she thought she was doing them a favor, you know, doing her duty by raising the flag. And they went after her, and she survived, much like the former FBI whistleblower Sybelle Edmonds, who in 2001 joined the FBI as a translator, and then she, you know, began to see huge amounts of corruption, of you know, all sorts of really dodgy stuff going on, and she thought she was doing her duty by raising awareness to this problem and so on, and they basically told her to shut up. So she, you know, she did for a while, but then I think she carried on and she kept raising trouble. And they said, look, if you don't shut up, we'll sack you. So I think she did shut up again, and then they sacked her anyway. So, and she wrote a book. She's written a couple of books now where she's talked about her experience, and she claims that she's the most gagged woman in the US. But again, you know, they went after somebody who was trying to highlight problems within the system. So it doesn't end well for people, generally speaking, who try to do that. And so that is an example then of how people in leadership positions, they know this, whether they know it, whether it's spelt out, which I don't think it would be, but it's implied, and there's a level of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, remember so-and-so, or, you know, what have you, Dr. Kelly, or I don't know, but there's any number of examples that you can point to. So at this point, politicians are just basically doing the bidding of the financial elite. And it seems to me the only way, and this is again what Catherine Austin Fitz has tried to explain, is to pull out from that system. So don't enable them. If you, and I should start doing this, but it's hard being in a different country to where my bank is. I bank with the evil corporation HSBC. And I really should pull everything out from there. But, you know, I've been banking with them since I was 16 at boarding school, and it was the Midland, you know, not HSBC. but anyway, use cash. Try and move your funds or your accounts out of the big five banks in the UK, for example. Banking in the UK is highly centralized. There is another bank, which is a very, it's a very unusual bank. It's a small bank. It may or may not be present in your town or city, but it is growing in the UK. And it's a bank that my dad banks at. So my dad actually pulled every single account, everything he had after my mum died, from HSBC. Again, my parents had banked with them since probably they were at uni in the 60s, and pulled it out and put it into Handelsbank, which I believe is a German bank. Make of that what you will, but it's a small local bank, and they have a very kind of old-fashioned way of doing business. So they don't have a traditional counter, and you go into the bank, and you meet with one of the staff face to face in a room, and they offer you coffee or tea or water or whatever you fancy, and you just talk about what you need and what you'd like and what you want to do. And it's a completely different type of experience you get from the high street banks. So if you aren't familiar with Handelsbank, you know, look into them. Look into any other sorts of local community banks. you know, that's the first step, I think, is to untangle your finances from the big five banks that control basically 99% of the money supply in the UK, and use cash. So, you know, withdraw whatever you can from your account to use that week. And that's a good way of budgeting as well. you know, because when you pay with plastic, you tend to forget how much money you've spent. Withdraw a sum of money that you think is going to be what you can live off that week, and just stick to that and try and stick to that. Don't shop with the, you know, big four if you can at all. You know, go try and start a cooperative with various organic cooperatives like Suma or whatever. There's various cooperatives, or go direct to farmers and get your fruit and veg direct from farmers if you can. Just try and de-digitalize and break away from the control of the big Mr. Global, as it were.
Well, okay. So a lot of the talk about COVID, and I think, I mean, I was at a pub last night chatting with some people from Stand in the Park. Actually, it was a terrific crew and a very, very lively pub, which was bursting at the seams. What they were saying was that basically what they're doing is they are bringing a lot of this technology, and maybe they're paranoid, maybe not. That's been tried and tested in China, it's being used in Hong Kong, etc. now, and implementing that in the West. So although we still have freedom of speech to a certain extent, and we're not getting locked up for criticising President Xi or laughing at the Chinese national anthem, actually what's happening is all of the kind of control grid for a kind of human farm is being implemented in the West now, Catherine.
Yeah. And so that's why we need to de-digitalize. And it's going to be tough, because people have got used to having the convenience of a mobile phone. I mean, look, you and I can remember, and it almost sometimes it boggles my mind, and I have to think pretty hard, like, how did we actually do things, Tony, before we had mobile phones? How did we book travel? We had to go to a travel agent and they did it for us. How did we make plans and tell people that we were going to meet them in a different country X number of weeks away or months away? I mean,
how did we navigate around the city to find the right building or around the country without a sat nav?
Well, yeah, that too. You know, and we're losing all of those sorts of things. It's a practice. The more you do it, the more you are confident in doing it, right? And you're activating parts of your brain when you're doing that, making choices. You know, forward planning, all of those forward planning skills we are losing because we are doing everything at the last minute. And all of our plans can change on an instant because we can contact people and say, oh, look, I'm sorry, I can't make it. And even just, you know, giving them 5 minutes, 10 minutes notice, where in the past that would have been unthinkable. And also you would have, you know, if something had happened and somebody didn't show up when you were expected to meet them, you know, you wouldn't go into panic mode about that. You would think, well, there's possibly a, you know, there's a perfectly legitimate reason why they can't make it. So, well, I'll just do something else. And then we'll catch up at home on the landline and, you know, we'll find out what happened. And you and I, we still have that kind of basic understanding of how the world used to work. But, you know, the younger generation have no concept of that whatsoever. And that's, you know, as I was saying to my husband this morning, never mind the over 80s and the over 70s. Even us, the over 40s, we're kind of irrelevant in the future that they have, constructed. They don't care what we think about it, because they're going for the children, as you say, Tony.
So all of this. Right. It's coming back to this. This is not Nazi Germany thing, isn't it? Around these COVID passes, where the idea is, they're going for the youngest people, basically the people in their formative years, to try and get them conditioned. And literally, this is a form of conditioning that you are going to be behaving like this in the future.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And to condition them to be afraid of pathogens, to be in fear for their life about unknown things, and to be completely dependent on the word of government approved authority figures. Yeah, it's really very dark. And I seriously, I'm both angry and sad for the children whose parents are totally going along with all of this and enforcing it in their own homes. It really appalls me. But I know there are parents who are not, and who are explaining things to their kids as it goes along. I try and tell my child, unfortunately, my daughter is, really into, she's very creative, and she's really into gaming and narrative building, storytelling. She loves all the online stuff, Minecraft worlds and so on. She loves all that stuff. And I keep trying to explain to her that they eventually want us all hooked up to a virtual reality and maybe drugged or dosed with just sufficient nutrients to keep us ticking over. That is the ultimate dystopia. So she's aware of that fact, and she's aware of the fact that all the advertising and all the influences online, they're all trapped in this narrative that the virtual world is so seductive. And there's no doubt that it's going to be highly addictive and highly seductive. We already know that because of the of the way people are addicted to their phones.
Well, having had a look at some of the marketing to do with these computer games, and what they say is, look, to whoever's playing these games, what they're doing is they're getting a sense of power. But to you, as a person that's selling them, this is money. So the idea really is giving people that play games, whether it's just these computer games, I suppose it used to be the arcade games years ago, the idea is that they get a sense of that they've got some power, where actually they've been totally disempowered in the real world. So in a way, what's happening is everybody, particularly youngsters, are being chased away from the real world, which is becoming a more and more hostile environment, whether it's a zero-hour contract or, that sort of... whether their union is failing to support them because they don't want to have a jab, whatever, into this kind of virtual reality world where they are more happy and more content. That's pretty sinister.
It's very sinister. And a lot of people draw parallels with The Matrix. I don't even remember if I watched The Matrix, to be honest. Most people think it was the greatest, or some people think it was the greatest film ever. I may have watched some of it. I don't think it appealed to me at the time. But
I think if you've seen The Matrix, it's one of those that you don't really unknow it. And we were playing a testimony a few weeks ago from some chap that had a near-death experience of hell. And actually, there were quite a lot of parallels with The Matrix. So I wonder whether some of the people that wrote the film, designed and produced the film, had some sort of inkling of that kind of vision of hell that you can get from a near-death experience. So I think it's a pretty, I mean, the idea basically being that everybody is locked in a cube and being completely controlled by demonic forces who are controlling the world that they see, which is a complete illusion. And they can, if they're very lucky, and I don't know, whatever, they get the light of Christ or something touches them, then they can be disconnected from that and just see what situation they're in for a minute and then start to fight against it. That's the Matrix in a nutshell, I guess. And you know, it's obviously got this thing with the red pill and the blue pill. So are you really, do you really want to go there kind of thing, which I think is a question a lot of people need to ask themselves. Do you, how far do you want to go to find out how bad things are? Because obviously that's going to repel many people and they don't want to have to deal with that. Simply they just put it out of their mind.
Yeah. Well, I'm, part of me thinks, well, why would the system, as it were, bother to keep people alive in that state? What would be the function of them? You know, so yeah. I think, I don't know, that it shouldn't be too, I mean, it's pretty, I've seen, you know, there's a lot of stuff though that I think a lot of this is like total psychological operations on so many levels of disempowering people, making them feel disempowered, making them feel disillusioned. And I mean, it's bad, but there are sometimes stories that come out, and I don't know if that's deliberate or whether it's people who just basically are jumping on stories because we're so addicted to having shocking, breaking stories every 24 hours. And so, you know, so consequently, even people in the so-called new media just jump on anything before it's verified, before it can be sourced. And then they, you know, and then it gets fact checked or whatever. And people think, we've got to the stage now where people think anything that's fact checked is true. And so the psychological operation is on such a scale that I think they deliberately put out stories which are really crazy and really, you know, then they're not true. They're patently, they cannot be verified, and they're not true. And yet they sound feasible to those of us who already know that things are really, really bad. And then what happens is people try and shed some light on that crazy story and say, look, no, that hasn't actually been verified. There's no real evidence that that is true. The real story is this, however. So I'm thinking of the example, and it's maybe people who listen to you are going to say, you know, oh God, how can she not see that that's a true story? But I'm thinking of the story about, there was a doctor, well, he claimed to be a doctor. I don't think he actually was a doctor, who said that these jabs are actually act like nano razors in the body. And so these nano razors that somehow are part of the ingredients of the jab lacerate the inside of your blood vessels and organs and so on. And then apparently after he made that claim, 2 days later, he died. Or was maybe killed. And so this has gone viral in just everywhere you looked. It was going viral for 2 weeks, 3 weeks ago. And I basically ignored it. I tried to ignore it, but it just kept coming back. I think stories like that are designed to make people think when the reality comes out. So the reality could be that, you know, the spike protein and the nature of how the spike protein works in your body is that it lacerates the inside of your blood vessels and then causes both hemorrhage and clotting. So it does both, right? But when you say it's a spike protein, it doesn't have the same cachet and the same shock factor as nano razor blades, right? And so then people kind of go, oh, it's not that bad, actually. That's kind of my gut feeling about how a lot of these, you know, really scary, it's bad. The reality is really bad already, but it's not bad in a really kind of sexy, high, futuristic kind of way.
Trying to succeed, I think, in looking on the positive side, with such an enormous Tory rebellion against the first real attempt to impose these COVID passports, and in actually a quite a limited way, I think we may have seen, I mean, you know, we're seeing, starting to see almost like a snowball effect. So as more and more people realise, well, actually there is a momentum behind a rebellion against this, that what we're starting to see is a pretty strong concerted movement from within the Tory party itself, which is actually in many ways better than coming from within the Labour Party, because this then threatens the government itself. So you may have the 1922 committee just deciding, well, we've had enough of Boris, we're going to put someone else in charge. And there's all sorts of people that may be. So this is more of a threat to Boris than the Labour Party potentially would have been, Catherine. And actually, it bodes very well for the future that there is a well-organised, well-resourced movement against all this.
Yeah, I may not be quite as hopeful as you. I mean, I think Boris is dreadful. Many of the people that Boris has surrounded himself with are absolutely appalling, abysmal, dreadful people. But I think Keir Starmer and what is currently, you know, in charge of the Labour Party, I think they're far, far worse and much, much more dangerous. And what I fear is the collapse of the Tory party and the Tory voter base. And somehow, potentially a completely manipulated vote, but a vote in favor of Labour, which would push through so much more of these agendas at a much, much more rapid pace, I think. So I think we need to be very careful what we're actually supporting. I think we definitely have to support people who are speaking out, make sure that they feel validated, that what they did was the right thing in voting against it, give them more moral courage to continue to rebel and to put up roadblocks wherever they can. But not only that, but to educate them that they must not vote for any more of the enabling acts. You know, so the Official Secrets Act is still up for renewal. They were talking about making it a 14-year sentence, from a 2-year maximum sentence to a 14-year sentence. And that would just be, I mean, we already have very draconian laws against whistleblowing and so on under the Official Secrets Act. We have to open up channels to these rebelling MPs and really, really encourage them and educate them about why it is essential. These things are not supported and are shot down before they're raised. Because they've got to understand that it will affect their families as well. All of this, the slide into tyranny, as we've been saying, is going to impact most greatly on the next generation. You know, the kids in school now, kids going into university, kids going into the job market, and you know, as adults, it's them who are going to be most affected by all of this. And so, yeah, get get on to the, obviously there's going to be a period of where Parliament is going to be in recess or whatever for the Christmas and New Year period, but get the names of those MPs, get onto them and, you know, support them, and get onto the MPs in your area who did vote for these acts, and tell them that you will not vote for them when it comes to election time. You will not support any of their proposals unless they start changing their tune. Because, you know, I think as we said about this disempowering thing, you know, sending in petitions on change.org and things like that, they've conditioned us to think that that's a participatory process. It's not, because none of those things seem to have changed anything. They've made no difference. We need to actually physically get out there, make appointments to see your MP, call your MP, write to your MP, get in their faces, not in a bad way, in a polite and, you know, civil way, challenge them and de-digitalize and disconnect. And if you have kids, try and encourage them to do things that are not dependent on the big tech and Mr. Global.
Can I ask you finally about Taiwan? Because there's all this sort of saber rattling seems to be going on right now, with the threat that the Chinese might just pounce and invade it, and there's nothing the Americans can do. What are your thoughts about, is this saber rattling or are the Chinese serious?
I don't think they're that serious. I think that's a storm in a teacup. Obviously, you know, as much as I know that Taiwan is pretty much has been a kind of a stooge of the US state, I grew up in Taiwan. I'd much rather live in Taiwan, although I'm not so sure about it now. Previously, I would have much, much rather live in Taiwan than in China. I think the Taiwanese people they have way more freedom than people in China. And they don't want to be part of China, not the way China is right now, especially when looking at Hong Kong. So I think this whole thing is just going to drag out, as it has done for the last 50 years. It's going to continue to drag on. There'll be saber rattling here and there. And a lot of it is being pushed, of course, by the US. So I think China and Taiwan need to kind of pull back and go, look, we're just going to carry on, because they were getting on fairly well in terms of the economic. You know, there were even Chinese tourists going to Taiwan. There was a ton of Taiwanese people investing in China, you know, loads of businesses. There was loads of cross-strait business and economic, and people traveling and visiting their homeland where they originally come from in China, for instance, and people from China going to visit Taiwan and so on and so forth. And there's even, you know, cross-marriaging going on and all that kind of intermarrying and what have you. So it's not a simple, straightforward story. And most people just want to get on with their life. Just leave us alone and let us get on with our lives. And they need to tell the US to get their finger out. But, you know, the US is a big investor in Taiwan, so they might not want to say that.
Yeah, well, I wonder if maybe many of the Taiwanese would just wish the Americans would shut up and, you know, maybe keep their warships at some sort of normal distance away.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of this is distraction as well, you know, from US politics and so on. I mean, the US is definitely very concerned about China. And I remember when, you know, growing up in Taiwan, I had a friend whose dad was an ambassador. Eventually, he became an ambassador for the Taiwanese government, even though previously He'd been on their blacklist when it was a military dictatorship. And, you know, they said that basically the US needs Taiwan in the way of China because of that territorial water. So at the moment, the Chinese government, although they have been building ships at a massive rate and they have a huge fleet, but they can't project their naval power as far out to sea as they would like, and because they don't have total access to all of the water, all of the sea, all of the ocean around their coast, you know, because they've got Japan at the top and they've got Taiwan down at the bottom and Okinawa in the middle. Ideally, this is why China does not want to give up Taiwan, because they would love to have Taiwan under their sphere of control so that they could then have ownership, have rights over that water around all around Taiwan. So it's a realpolitik, you know, it's just a delicate balancing act. And yeah, basically the US is a stick in the ointment.
Okay, Catherine Gunn, thanks very much for joining us.
I hope you have a good Christmas and defy any measures that the government has on you.